You're listening to DTFHN for July 16th, 2026. I'm your open weight, full disclosure host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people who read the source code argue with people who read the headline. Today's a day for cracking things open and finding out what's actually inside. Let's get into it. Let me make the strongest case against music piracy first. The music industry built something real. Labels funded recording sessions, pressing plants, distribution networks. Artists got advances. The system, for all its exploitation, did produce an extraordinary volume of recorded music. When piracy hollowed out that revenue, real people lost real jobs. Not executives, but session musicians, sound engineers, the woman running the merch table. That's the honest version of the anti-piracy argument, and it deserves respect. Now let me tell you why it collapses on its own terms. What.cd was not a piracy site. I mean, legally, yes, obviously. But functionally, it was the largest, most meticulously organized music archive in human history, built and maintained entirely by volunteers. No venture capital, no product managers, no quarterly earnings calls, just people who loved music enough to build infrastructure around it. Pull this down to first principles. What does an archive actually require? Comprehensive catalog, reliable availability, quality standards, community curation, discovery tools. What.cd had all of these, and it had them because of its architecture. Not despite it. The private tracker model is a masterclass in incentive design. You track upload to HIND at load ratios per account. You enforce seeding requirements. You create a bounty system where users spend ratio credits to request missing albums, and other users fulfill those requests. The result is a self-sustaining ecosystem where the act of sharing directly benefits the sharer. A former moderator describes finding music through word clouds of connected artists, through user-curated collages organized by themes as specific as every album with a train on the cover. That's not theft. That's a community building the Library of Alexandria, one FLAC file at a time. And here's what replaced it. Streaming platforms where albums vanish overnight because a licensing deal expired. Where the Norwegian business magazine's archives aren't available. Where an algorithm decides what you hear next based on what keeps you listening longest. Not what might genuinely change how you think about sound. The readers in the comments nail it. One points out that Apple sold iPods knowing full well nobody was buying 40,000 songs at a dollar each. The hardware makers understood. The infrastructure wanted to be open. It was the rights holders. The gatekeepers standing on the ladder. Who insisted on artificial scarcity? What.cd proved something profound before it was shut down. A community of passionate people, given the right tools and the right incentive structures, will build something more comprehensive, more reliable, and more culturally valuable than any corporation. The tools exist. The knowledge is available. The only thing that killed it was legal architecture designed to protect revenue streams. Not music. The catalog they built was a gift. The system that destroyed it was a choice. Sharp left turn, story 2 from music archives to AI empires. Let's talk about where Y Combinator's founders are actually ending up these days. One commenter put it plainly, UIC has tens of thousands of founders. 105 of them ending up at two companies doesn't prove anything. Another asked about the denominator. After 20 years of batches, with startup failure rates being what they are, some percentage of alumni landing at the two hottest companies in tech is just gravity, not a trend. They're right about the math, but they're wrong about what makes this interesting. The question nobody in that thread is asking is this. What does it mean when the most celebrated startup program on Earth becomes a feeder system for two companies? And both of those companies are closed? Why, Combinator's entire mythology is about building, about founders who see something broken in the world and ship a fix, about independence, ownership, the garage to greatness arc. The batch numbers in this dataset tell a story the site doesn't editorialize on. Look at 2020. 13 founders, 2000 and Hyde Thor. 14. The acceleration is recent. These aren't people whose startups failed a decade ago and drifted into big tech. These are founders from the last few years making a deliberate choice to stop bounding and start working inside someone else's architecture. One comment cuts closest to the bone. Industry roles are a tiered system determining access to cash flow. The YC founder wrote, is just a faster way to secure a high tier than climbing the engineering ladder. Read that again. The implication is that founding a startup, going through YC, building something, watching it struggle or fail. That entire experience functions as a credential, a resume line that gets you past the gatekeepers at Anthropic or OpenAI. The startup wasn't the point. The startup was the audition. And the thing that should trouble anyone who cares about open technology is where these builders are flowing. Both OpenAI and Anthropic build powerful systems behind closed doors. The weights are proprietary. The training data is proprietary. The deployment infrastructure is proprietary. 105 people who are trained to build independent founder-led companies are now building inside two organizations whose entire competitive strategy depends on keeping the architecture closed. Follow the money. One commenter says, fair enough, but when the money pulls a builder class into closed systems, that's not just career migration. That's a brain drain away from the open ecosystem. Every engineer inside a closed lab is an engineer not contributing to open models, open datasets, open infrastructure. The talent pipeline that was supposed to democratize technology is concentrating it. That deserves a serious conversation. Moving on. In 1997, Digital Equipment Corporation had the fastest chip on the planet. The Alpha processor was a marvel of engineering, and DEC's strategy was to keep it proprietary, license it carefully, control the ecosystem. Within 2 years, Compaq bought DEC. Within 5, the Alpha was dead. Meanwhile, the x86 architecture. Messy, backwards compatible, available to anyone who wanted to build on it, ate the world. The best technology lost because the architecture was closed. The adequate technology won because anyone could touch it. Thinking Machines just released Ingu, 975 billion parameters total, 41 billion active. Mixture beats XDrob. Transformer, trained on 45 trillion tokens of text, images, audio, and video. 1 million token context window. Full weights available. And here's the part that made me actually laugh. They had the model fine-tune itself. Inkling wrote its own fine-tuning job on their platform Tinker. Trained itself to be a lipogram model that never uses the letter E, evaluated its own results, and switched to the updated weights, the snake eating its own tail. Except the tail is a training pipeline. Now run this forward 5 years. Every open weights model that ships with a customization platform is a seed, not a product. A sounding tube. Someone in Lagos fine-tunes Ifor Yoruba medical terminology. Someone in Sao Paulo adapts it for Brazilian legal documents. Someone in a garage in Wisconsin makes it do something nobody at Thinking Machines ever imagined. That's not a hypothetical future. That's what happened with Linux, with Apache, with every open system that ever mattered. The original authors become the smallest fraction of the total contribution. Thinking Machines said something remarkably honest in their announcement. Inkling is not the strongest overall model available today. Open or close. They just said it out loud, and then they explained why that's not the point. It's a base for customization, a foundation you reshape for your problem. That's the Alpha versus A86 lesson all over again. Raw benchmark supremacy is the DEC play. Broad availability and adaptability is the play that actually wins. One commenter noted they've only ever seen this kind of gap between public benchmarks and private evaluation quality with Anthropic's models. The benchmarks measure the wrong thing. They measure the model you downloaded. They don't measure the model it becomes. 4 stories in, and we're still accelerating. This next one goes all the way down to first principles. When I was building an interface system last year, I needed a component that responded to clicks. Simple requirement. I wrote one from scratch because the native version didn't style the way I wanted. 14 hours later, I was debugging why screen readers couldn't find it, why keyboard users couldn't activate it, why touch events on mobile fired twice. I had mass. I did not have an organ. That distinction matters. A biologist will tell you that a human kidney contains roughly 1 million nephrons. Each one a filtration unit evolved over 400 million years. You could, theoretically, build a kidney from raw cells. You would need to replicate the glomerular basement membrane, the countercurrent multiplier system, the renin-angiotensin feedback loop, the precise osmotic gradients across the loop of Henle. Or, you could just use the kidney. The HTML button element is a kidney. Marco Campos cataloged what a native button actually does, and the list is staggering in its quiet completeness. Keyboard focus management, tab order integration, activation via enter, space, click, touch, and pointer events independently. Disabled states that remove the element from both the tab order and the accessibility tree simultaneously. Focus ring management that distinguishes keyboard navigation from pointer interaction. Form submission behavior. The ARIA press toggle pattern. High contrast mode compatibility. Correct behavior under Windows, macOS, iOS, and Android accessibility APIs, each with their own expectations. That is 37 discrete requirements by his count, each mapped to specific Buckhage success criteria. 37 evolutionary adaptations in a single HTML tag that browsers hand you for free. The article frames this as a warning, and it is. But the clinical fact underneath is more interesting. Browsers are among the most sophisticated open source software ever built. Chromium alone represents over $1 billion of accumulated engineering. Every native element carries that inheritance. When a developer writes a div with an onclick handler and calls it a button, they are not simplifying. They are discarding $1 billion of solve problems to save 45 minutes. One commenter noted that AI code generators are now trained on exactly this kind of shortcut code, perpetuating the pattern at scale. The tools exist. The knowledge is available. The native elements are right there, carrying decades of accessibility engineering in every tag. The only requirement is that you use them. Moving on. 7 blue ports. Every single one of them sporting that telltale blue tongue that says USB 3.0. Pop the case open and count the pins. 6 of those 7 ports have 4 pins. 4. That's USB 2.01 port. Exactly 1. Has the full complement for USB 3.0. The other 6 are wearing a costume. A blogger named Gof Liu bought a generic 7-port USB 3.0 hub off AliExpress for about $5 during end of financial year sales and did what any self-respecting tinkerer would do. He cracked it open. What he found inside is a masterclass in the economics of deception at scale. The architecture is almost admirable in its cynicism. 2 HS8836A chips. These are bare-bones 4-port USB 2.0 hub controllers, the kind hobbyists use because they don't even need an external crystal. The USB 3.0 cable from your computer hits one real USB 3.0 port, and then the 2.0 lines fan out through these chips to everything else. It's essentially a USB 3.0 extension cable duct-taped to a USB 2.0 hub. The blue plastic is doing all the heavy lifting. This reminds me of the M-Machines era, late 1990s, when budget PC manufacturers would slap Pentium-class stickers on boxes running Cyrix processors. Same playbook. The spec sheet says one thing, the silicon says another, and the price point is the tell. $5 for a 7-port USB 3.0 hub was never a deal. It was a confession. But here's where builder culture matters. One of the commenters nailed it. Paying more doesn't guarantee better. The OEM pockets the difference. Without teardowns, without people like Leo who grab a spudger and publish what they find, there's no accountability layer. The datasheets for the HS8836A are publicly available. The pin counts are VSHable. The tools to check exist. Someone just has to use them. The really dangerous detail is buried near the end. The external power barrel jack commons directly with the USB power lines without any switching or protection circuitry. Plug in an external supply and it backfeeds into your computer's USB port. Leo notes this has been a known damage vector for over 20 years. $5 buys you one USB 3.0 port, 6 USB 2.0 ports in disguise, mechanical joints held together by optimism instead of solder, and a power design that might fry your motherboard. The schematic is the product's only honest document. And they didn't include one. Liu had to reverse engineer the truth. That's the kind of work that makes open hardware culture essential. Not the grand gestures, not the manifestos, just someone with a pry tool and a camera saying, here's what's actually inside. That same instinct to preserve and share what matters. When X Up, a digital rescue mission 16 decades in the making. 6 shillings. That was the price per volume of the Naturalist Library when it launched in the 1830s. Adjusted for inflation, that's roughly £40 today. Call it $50 for a pocket-sized book packed with hand-colored illustrations of every creature the British Empire had managed to catalog. The publisher, William Jardine, wasn't building a luxury product. He was building a distribution system. 40-plus volumes. Small enough to fit on a working person's shelf. Price to move. 1,300 color plates of birds, mammals, insects, fish. The entire known animal kingdom, democratized through print technology and aggressive pricing. Now Nicholas Rajou has done it again. This is the same designer who previously restored Euclid's Elements and Twining's Botanical Illustrations as free digital editions. His method is meticulous. scanning original plates, cleaning artifacts, rebuilding color fidelity, documenting every decision in public blog posts that read like conservation reports. The craft here deserves attention. Each of those 1,300 illustrations had to be individually assessed, corrected, and rendered for screen display while preserving the aesthetic vocabulary of 19th century natural history illustration. That's where the colored subject pops against a monochrome habitat background. A technique that looks stunning and also happens to be incredibly difficult to digitize faithfully. Follow Jardine's original principle to its logical conclusion. If the goal was always access, putting the natural world's catalog into ordinary hands, then Rougeau's web edition is the fulfillment, not the deviation. Free, brobled, no institutional library card required. The entire collection, searchable and shareable, sitting on infrastructure that would have seemed like pure fantasy to a Victorian naturalist. One commenter cut straight to it by linking directly to the library at ca2.net, bypassing the article entirely. That's the behavior of someone who wants the primary source, not the commentary about the primary source. Builder culture recognizing builder culture, Rougeau is transparent about using AI tools during the restoration. For sourcing references, filling visual gaps, brainstorming cover designs. The interesting part isn't that he used AI. It's that he documented exactly how and where, treating it as another tool in the conservator's kit, rather than something to hide or something to hype. The work speaks, 1,300 plates, cleaned and published and given away. Jardine charged 6 shillings because print was expensive. Rougeau charges nothing because the web isn't. The mission was always the same. The technology finally caught up. Now for something completely different. Story 7. Grok Bill. Rust. That's the first thing worth noticing about Grok Bill's source dump. Not the branding, not the corporate strategy, not the fact that XAI spent $60 billion on Cursor and then open-sourced a competing tool anyway. The language choice. Because when you're building a terminal native coding agent, something that needs to manage file I/O, shell execution, process supervision, and a full screen TUI simultaneously. Russ's ownership model isn't a stylistic preference. It's an engineering constraint that pays dividends. Memory safety without a garbage collector means your agent isn't going to pause mid-edit to clean up after itself. Pull the repository apart and the architecture tells a story. Separate crates for the TUI rendering, the agent runtime, the tool implementations, the workspace abstraction. That's not a monolith someone carved up for the release. That's modular design from the start. The workspace crate handles file system access, version control, execution, and checkpoints. Which means the agent's relationship to your code base is mediated through a clean abstraction layer, not scattered file operations. Buried in there is a self-contained terminal renderer for mermaid diagrams. Someone built an entire diagramming engine that runs in your terminal. That's the kind of detail you only find by reading source. Now, the open-close test, Apache 2.0 license. That's genuinely permissive. Someone already forked it into a project called Gork Build within hours. The code is readable, buildable, forkable. But the contributing.md says external contributions are not accepted. Read that again. The source is open. The process is closed. You can look. You can fork. You can learn. But you cannot participate in the upstream. That's a meaningful architectural choice about where power sits. The strategic calculus is transparent and honestly kind of beautiful. If you're trailing in market share, and XAI's coding tools are trailing, open sourcing your harness is the rational move. 1,000 developers reading your agent runtime, understanding it, building on it, is worth more than whatever proprietary advantage secrecy buys. Meta figured this out with Llama. The trailing player's optimal strategy and the public good happen to align perfectly. One commenter raised the data exfiltration issue, and it's worth acknowledging. Trust is architectural too. Open sourcing the client means anyone can audit exactly what gets sent where. That's not absolution. It's accountability through transparency. The code is there. Read it. The tools exist. The source is available. Build something. We've been circling this theme all episode, so let's just say it out loud. Next up, the policy case for open source AI. Can a library exist if nobody funds the librarian? That question sits at the center of David Siegel's argument in Fortune this month, and it deserves a straight answer. Siegel, who runs the Siegel Family Endowment, is calling on governments, corporations, and nonprofits to actively invest in free and open source AI. Not as charity, not as PR, as infrastructure. Now, here's where I want to play devil's advocate for a moment, because one of the strongest objections showed up in the comments. Commercial AI will usually dominate because developers are paid to make it their primary effort. Goodwill and part-time contributions cannot compete. That sounds right. It sounds like basic economics. And it is completely, historically wrong. Linux runs the internet. Apache served the web for 2 decades. PostgreSQL powers half the startups on the planet. The pattern is always the same. Proprietary systems sprint ahead on funding. Open systems win on compounding. 1,000 engineers contributing freely will always eventually outpace 100 engineers building behind a wall, because openness is a multiplier. Every contribution benefits every participant. Closed development is additive. Open development is exponential. But Siegel's point goes further than just efficiency. The argument is about power. When the most consequential technology in human history is controlled by 4 or 5 companies, the question isn't whether those companies are benevolent today. The question is, what happens when their incentives shift? And incentives always shift. One commenter made an observation that cuts deep. Most open models today are closer to receiving a compiled binary than receiving an actual library. You get the weights. You don't get the training data. You don't get the full pipeline. You don't get reproducibility. That's not open source in any meaningful sense. It's a demo with extra steps. Real openness means the whole stack. Training data, methodology, infrastructure documentation, everything someone would need to rebuild it from scratch. The inducement prize idea from the comments is worth pulling on. $200,000 to the first model that hits a minimum threshold on a specific benchmark, awarded every 6 to 12 months. That's not enough money to build a frontier model, but it's enough to focus a community. Prizes don't fund the work. They validate it. They tell 1,000 researchers that someone is watching, someone cares. The work matters beyond the work itself. Funding open AI infrastructure is not generosity. It is self-preservation. The alternative is a world where the most powerful cognitive tools ever built are controlled by entities whose fiduciary duty is to shareholders. The tools to prevent that consolidation exist. The models are improving. The communities are real. What's missing is the institutional will to treat open AI the way we treat roads and bridges and water systems, as something too important to leave to the market alone. We talked earlier about building foundations that last, pause, and nobody embodies that ethos quite like SQLite. Let's pull this thread. The strongest argument for SQLite's terrible defaults is that they've worked for 20 years, billions of devices. Literally the most deployed database engine on the planet. Every Android phone, every iPhone, every Firefox installation, every copy of iTunes. If the defaults were truly broken, the whole house of cards would have collapsed by now. You don't argue with a 20-year track record. Except you do. Because the track record isn't 20 years of correctness. It's 20 years of every single developer who touches SQL Lite for the first time learning the hard way that foreign key constraints are decorative. Their suggestions. You define a foreign key. SQL Lite nods politely and then ignores it completely. Your carefully modeled relational schema is a fiction. Delete a user. Their posts just float there, orphaned. Until the database reassigns that row ID to someone new, and suddenly, Alice is credited with Bob's posts. The horror isn't hypothetical. It's a Wednesday. And it gets better. Define a column as integer. And a SQLite will happily let you stuff a string in there. It calls this type affinity, which is a diplomatic way of saying your schema is more of a mood board. The fix for each of these is a one-line pragma. The knowledge exists. The documentation is thorough. But here's the bootstrapism problem. Every new developer has a discover. Independently, the tool they just picked up has the safety off. The pragma isn't the ladder. The pragma is the rung that's missing. You can climb if you already know it's gone, but the whole point of sane defaults is that you shouldn't need tribal knowledge to avoid data corruption. The author proposes Rust-style additions. Version your defaults. New projects get strict mode, foreign key enforcement, proper typing. Old databases keep working exactly as they did. Backward compatibility preserved. No breakage. Just a flag that says, I started this project in 2026. Please, treat my schema like I meant it. The beautiful part is how boring the solution is. No new features, no new syntax, just the database finally believing you when you tell it what your data looks like. We talked about infrastructure believing you earlier. Pause. Now the payments world is having its own trust renegotiation. $53 billion. That's the number Reuters is reporting for Stripe and Advent International's joint bid to acquire PayPal. And the first comment worth reading on Hacker News isn't about strategy or synergy. It's about the Hirschfeld-Hirschman Index. Someone did the math on market concentration for card-not-present transactions if you put Stripe, PayPal, Venmo, Braintree, and Zoom under one roof. The word they used was absurd. Strip this to first principles. What is a payment processor? A pipe. Money moves from one account to another. The technical differentiation between Stripe and Braintree is real but narrow. AP is developer experience, fraud modeling. The moat isn't technology. The moat is integration inertia. Millions of merchants wired into one pipe don't switch pipes because a better one exists. They switch when the current one breaks. Which brings up the comment that should worry every small merchant reading this. Stripe's content policies are significantly more restrictive than PayPal's. Cannabis-adjacent businesses. Adult-adjacent businesses. Categories PayPal processes today that Stripe refuses. If one company owns both pipes, those merchants don't have a fallback. They have a compliance department making moral judgments about legal commerce with no competitive pressure to reconsider. And then there's a workforce angle. Stripe cut 300 IT staff recently. PayPal has been trimming for 2 years. Consolidation in payments has never meant more jobs. It means fewer people maintaining more infrastructure. Which means... run this forward! Fewer people who understand the system when it breaks. The payments layer of the internet is plumbing. When two plumbing companies merge, your water bill doesn't go down. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for July 16th, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI generated. Scripts by Claude Sonnet 4.7. Voice by Quen 3 TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go share something that deserves to be found. We'll see you back here tomorrow.